Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue collar workers for blue collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Spring break isn't what it used to be. It's better. This spring, stay 3 nights and get a $50 Best Western gift card. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Visit bestwestern.com for complete terms and conditions.
Ready to relax in your dream bath retreat without the stress of figuring out every detail yourself? At the Home Depot, your bath upgrade is covered. Shop fully designed rooms and curated bath collections to go from inspiration to transformation fast. Savings of up to 40% will make it easier on your budget. And find everything you need, from tubs to toilets and all the tile in between, to bring your vision to life. The Home Depot. Dream baths built here.
Welcome to Maximize Your Hunt, the podcast dedicated to those who want the most out of their hunting property. This podcast explores land management, habitat improvement, and hunting strategies that will help you maximize your time in the field. Follow along as industry professionals that live and breathe white-tailed deer share their secrets to success. And now, the founder of Whitetail Landscapes, your host, John Teeter.
Hi, I'm John Teeter, Whitetail Landscapes. This is Maximize Your Hunt. Welcome back, everybody. Hopefully everybody's doing well. I just got back from a client visit, and those client visits, man, I just every day I wake up and I just appreciate so much the opportunity to change properties and just to revitalize. You know, somebody's got a property for 15 or 20 years that have been banging their head against the wall, and we come here and we change everything in 8 hours. You know, it was 8 hours of a sermon of just evolution, and I just feel so fortunate to be able to do what I'm doing. Today, I came home and I did some shed hunting. And I've been shed hunting for about 6-8 hours here. I think we did 8 or 9 miles. I'm a little tired. I mean, we did about 4 miles yesterday in the client property. So, and I worked out this morning. So I'm staying in shape, that's for sure. And I was with some old timers shed hunting, one of my good friends. These guys are, you know, they've been around the block. They've chased some antlers. And one of the guys, I don't even know his name. We just call him Shed Man. He was just, He found sheds. I mean, there's no doubt about it. The guy just is inevitably going to find something. It doesn't matter. It's just a time and place. He puts the right amount of effort in, and he has the vision. But, you know, we walked a lot of properties today, and we found one deadhead in a shed. So, you know, it's a lot of work. I mean, there's not a lot of deer in the areas that I'm at, so it's really tough for us to find success. These huge, just different deer populations, just different opportunities. And it just, you know, live and breathe the hunt that you have, and live and breathe the environments that you have, and try to make them the best you can. But I try not to look at social media, because it does get a little depressing and be like, boy, I just did, you know, 10 miles today and we found a shed, right? And just not a lot of deer sign in some areas. But again, fortunate to be out in the woods and enjoying myself and staying in shape. So I want to echo that for everybody that's in the field, you know, trying to make their property better or just looking for antlers. All right. I've got a returning guest, Colin, for Legendary Habitat. And we're going to answer some questions that I received some time ago. I've delayed getting Colin on just because I've had all these other, you know, non-consecutive guests on, just these one-and-done type guests. So I'm happy to get him back, and we'll kind of go through some questions and just check up and see how his consulting and work season's been. Colin, what's going on, brother?
How's it going? Thanks a lot for having me back on. I appreciate it.
Oh yeah. Yeah. This is where it's at, man. If you're not on this podcast, you're not cool. So I'm happy to have you back.
That's right. Absolutely. We have a lot of fun and learn a lot of things. So yeah, what it's all about.
Yep. Absolutely. So a couple things. First thing is, I just feel like, the more and more I pay attention to what you're doing on social media, the more I see you slowly turning into a logger. And, I don't know if that's your game, but it seems like you're scaling timber and you're, I watched you cut the other day and I said, are you trying to, there's a guy that we both know. I was like, are you a logger now? Or what are you doing? what have you been up to?
I mean, obviously, you know, my main goal, you know, for a lot of my clients is to really maximize not only, you know, the work that we're doing, the habitat development, but obviously, you know, maximize their success. And if we can, of course, get some income off of some of these properties, you know, as logging, obviously that's a huge component. And obviously logging is a huge component of opening up the canopy, trying to get a lot more sunlight down. It opens up a lot of different opportunities to do various different habitat, you know, improvements. So, you know, I've been working together now with just a couple clients, and I'm starting to get a little bit of equipment now where I can do some of these kind of smaller scale logging operations. And I've got some good relationships with some people, some loggers and some buyers and stuff like that. And really my goal is to kind of fit the gap between, you know, large scale, you know, operations where, you know, a lot of times I've got a lot of clients in that range where they've got some quality timber on their property, but they just don't have the volume there, you know, to have, you know, large equipment come on there, or, you know, they don't want the large equipment on their property because they're, you know, risking tearing things up, which I understand. And so that's kind of, you know, what I've been trying to fill that gap with some of my clients where we really need the trees out of there just for the sunlight. A lot of their goal is, you know, whitetail habitat. And so we need the sunlight to really get in there where we can really do all of our TSI or bedding cuts. And it's just, I just found it's a way better finished product. When you can get in there, you can do all your layout. And that's what I've been trying to do with my clients, is basically kind of turnkey. So we come in, we do all the logging, we do all the layout, and then I can get in and do all the habitat work for them too at the same time. So it's kind of a one and done, you know, type thing. Obviously there's follow up maintenance and all that stuff that needs to be done, but, in the initial steps. And, so yeah, it's been working well. And, you know, my main goal is the client's, you know, success, that they're happy, and, you know, that we have a really good finished product. So
yeah,
that's kind of what I've been up to with that stuff.
Well, I love that piece of it. I love that you're trying to fill the niche that, you know, it meets both needs. You are trying to enhance wildlife behavior and interest on the property, break. You're getting them some economic gains, break. You're filling the niche, because a lot of people don't even know how to go from A to Z, and you're taking it from A to Z, you're doing all the hard work. And the volume of work that it takes to work on these properties, so these old timers today, we went over to my property and just kind of walked around, and they were like, you know, one of them's been on my property before, and he's just a great guy. And they're just kind of amazed at how much effort's been given to like a property like that. And, you know, they're sitting there talking to me like, what the heck's going on here? You know, this is, we've never seen anything like this. And I said to him, yeah. I said, you know, it's not about being different. It's about it's kind of like a caterpillar. It's metamorphosizing into something greater. And I said, it takes a lot of thought. And I said, I've made a lot of mistakes here. And I said, basically, you know, it looks fantastic, but it's a proving ground. And I said, I could tell you 5,000 things that I've done wrong here. And I said, if I didn't have a chance to kind of destroy is a bad word, but not impact the property exactly the way they wanted, I wouldn't be as successful as I am today. And so I take those lessons into these properties that I'm working now. And I've been telling clients, like, I'm actually physically now trying to work on more client properties myself, just because I know that I'm so technical that I can't even explain to anybody else. I have been on at least 5 properties this year consulting on where there's been active foresters on all the properties, and I've disagreed with 90% of the recommendations. And I'm saying to myself, you're not doing your client justice. And then these other guys that are trying to get into the business of consulting, they're just hunting guys. Like, we just know hunting. I'm like, and I've said this to you before. I'm like, you know, if you're going to take information and utilize it from a gentleman that wants to get in this, I wouldn't pay a whole lot. I mean, the guy's got to have 10 or 15 years of experience before I'd even let him step on my property. And break, I don't care about these damn celebrities either. You know, folks out there that have celebrity status is like, I don't know. You know, I think I've told you this before. That is meaningless to me. What's your success rate in a hard to hunt area? Tell me your experience of changing a property and explain to me every option that I have underneath the sun. And if you can give me those answers and you're very firm and you have experience to back that up, I'm picking that guy, you know? And I just, I'm saying that just because that's the one thing I've run into. And I'm just thinking to myself, I love that you're filling the niche, because I think there's folks that don't understand how to do this correctly. And it's not, there's no one perfect way, but there's better ways to do things. So I don't know if that resonates.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I totally can agree with that. And, you know, I guess one of the things that just kind of frustrates me, I guess, a little bit is just clients who have gone down the road of hiring several different people on their property. And, you know, I know we've discussed this before. And, you know, obviously it's great to get different ideas and perspectives and learn different things from different people, you know, obviously, which is that what I've done over the years. But, you know, I've seen a lot of people who have kind of chased after different things and kind of gone down certain roads that I don't think was the best for that particular property. And, you know, whether it be a logger or forester or something like that. And this is not a knock on any, you know, loggers or foresters, obviously some fantastic ones out there that understand whitetail habitat, the goals, how to manage it, you know, but obviously one of the big things that I've learned just after going on just lots of properties and getting to work on a lot of properties and do repeated work on properties is I start to really see obviously things that work and don't work from other people who have been there and done previous work, whether it be a client or a logger or something like that. And, you know, I was recently at a property in Southern Michigan doing some work, and a client had some loggers, you know, come in, and they kind of did what I would say more of kind of a rollout. So, you know, they kind of start at one corner and then they basically just kind of roll through the property. And, you know, they don't keep a lot of their main logging roads open. They close a lot off, and there's not a lot of organization or layout, you know? And so, you know, the client is actually not at the property. He actually lives in a different state. And, so, you know, we were just talking over, I was just filling him in on some recommendations that I would do moving forward before it gets really thick and it gets really hard to manage, is try to go back in there, you know, do some damage control, open up some of these areas, you know, where you can get in and you can manage this early succession growth because now he's actually, they actually did cut it hard enough where he's got really good sunlight going on, which is important, you know, but at the same time, there's still a lot of follow-up work before it just gets really, really thick. Yeah. So that's, you know, one of the things that I see,
Colin,
often on properties.
One thing I was going to mention to you is, if I was just in the business of putting, you know, taking canopy out of the equation and putting sunlight on the ground, if that was just like my business, I wouldn't be in business. And so to the point of a logger coming in and, you know, their focus on tree selection, again, there needs to be a methodology behind that tree selection. A lot of the foresters come in and they'll do kind of an aerial review. They will spot select trees in cohorts or individual, whether the terminology selector group cutting or the management style may or may not match the outcome you expect. And a lot of times it's not in a form or format that actually will create a high level interest from deer. Now on the reverse side, I was on a property probably a month ago now, and there was a complete clear cut, and they stacked slash way too intensely. There was no access roads. They left variable species in there that, you know, we're all likely going to get wind thrown at some point based on the soil. And they removed the biodiversity and killed a lot of the understory with herbicide. So basically it's denuded. And so the recovery time, and this is like on, I've seen this on multiple properties. The recovery time is going to be about 10 years. They're going to have 10 years of recovery time before that's even productive for anything. And I'm talking like a massed spectrum of wildlife. And so now you have to go in and you have to remediate those bad decisions. And great client. I mean, like an awesome client. But the outcome of those decisions is going to be, if it's not done correctly now, is going to be detrimental to their success. And I, you know, I said, boy, I wish, and he said this too, so it's fine, but I wish you had, I had you here before the forester came in. And the only reason why it wasn't a total disaster is every location. And by the way, most properties I go on, many folks put their hunting stands in embedding locations or focal areas for deer. They hunt sign, right? Everyone hunts sign, which is, we don't hunt sign. We should talk about that later. But they save the trees based on the stand locations, which happen to be the bedding locations. So, you know, the locations where there was a certain type of species in the Seco region was a net result of actually the landowner saving the property. The landowner was actually the smarter one in the equation between the forester. So, you know, I sit here and ask myself, what are you trying to achieve? And it's one of these, you could be as detailed and focused as possible and have a real prescription, or you could be completely abstract and just say, we're going to put sunlight on the ground. I just don't do that. I don't just put sunlight on the ground. So, you know, I think economics, and then I always think economics first. And I just, that's the way I've been. Ellinger's the same way. He'll readily admit that he thinks the same way. It's economics first. And then he makes his decision, you know, post that, you know, am I increasing habitat? What animal or species am I trying to focus in on? Am I creating more biodiversity in the landscape? What do I want to repopulate, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah. Well, and I think another thing, you mentioned the time aspect. You know, I wish you would have had me out there sooner or whatever. And I think, you know, I run into a lot of clients where, you know, they have the financial resources and they've got the property, or they might have the equipment, but they don't have the time. You know, they're busy, they're running businesses, they've got, you know, multiple different things going on, you know, in their life. And that's where, you know, I'm trying to, you know, best utilize my experiences and my skills and my network of people that I work with, to, you know, better utilize, you know, my time and their time, more importantly, to really be efficient in how we're breaking down and setting up a property, whether it be consulting, creating a plan, or it be cutting on a property, you know, to hopefully, you know, either speed up the process or hopefully cut down on, you know, their long-term damage, you know, versus, you know, having, you know, doing these different practices that could really hurt them in the long run. So,
yeah, I drafted recently, I think there's 60 different practices on a property that I suggest or would recommend employing. Maybe there's 70. I'd have to look. I came up a list with Tom Milsna, and we're coming up with all new concepts. I was kind of mentioning some stuff to you, I think, last time we talked. And, you know, just new concepts, design. I'm just trying to make sure that we're being intelligent enough to give people the right tools. And, you know, in my area, and I should do a podcast on just fire and why fire isn't appropriate in most areas that I work in. Because, I mean, all you hear now is fire, 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 fire. And I just keep thinking to myself, and people just think that's the answer. They get attached to stuff that is not applicable to their property. And and it's, or it's food plots, food plots, food plots. It's like, I mean, we don't have a slick of, or a spit of flat ground here. What are you talking about? You know, I'm just as, an, right. as yep. an example.
Yep.
Or we're going to put food plots in an area that doesn't relate well to the overall design. And you're stuck. I mean, I can't tell you how many properties I've been to. There's a landing site, which is highly compacted. And they're like, oh, well, this is an opening. And it's like, is this opening, you know, chain link to another design feature that I'm not aware of? Because it doesn't seem like that's going to do anything for you. Well, let's get into the Q&A, because I people like on this podcast is like, go get them, right? I want to get into the Q&A. I sent you a bunch of the questions. I'm going to read them. We'll probably discuss them. I might ask you some questions. I might add to it. But it's just really kind of a chance for you kind of to discuss maybe things you think are wrong with the question or right with the question, or maybe better ways to even ask a question like this. But we'll ask these, each one of these questions. We have four questions today. And it's just a chance for us to kind of engage. So I don't have any names associated with them, but everyone, thank you for sending in questions. And I appreciate your support on the podcast. All right. First question. The topic I'm having trouble with is creating a plot, I'm assuming a food plot, in a closed canopy forest. I cannot get the plants to grow well in my clearing. I'm not sure if the mature tree roots around the plot are leaching the nutrients from my crops. Not enough daylight, certain trace minerals. What should I be paying attention to? Should I cut the trees around the plot even back further? Should I treat the stumps to kill the roots? It's an opening around 100 feet across, east to west, 200 feet long, north to south. Thanks. That's the question. What are your thoughts on this question? He started answering his own question at the start of this. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so, you know, I run into this a lot with a lot of different clients. I get, you know, a lot of different questions similar to this. And typically what I find in most situations is a lack of sunlight as far as really getting things to grow and take off. So, you know, I kind of go through a step-by-step process, you know, for this. And obviously I don't know the situation and the property and stuff like that, but my first one is typically sunlight. You know, we got to make sure that plant's able to photosynthesize. You know, for most clients, I would say at least 6 hours a daylight, you know, for most crops or most food plot species that, you know, we're trying to grow. And then, you know, my next one would really be going through and seeing, you know, what is the situation with the soil, obviously, you know, and, you know, a really good thing you could do very easily to tell whether it's typically your sunlight or your, whether, you know, whatever you're planting, your soil is, you know, you can throw out, you know, you can do a cereal rye or an oats, and, you know, gosh, those will grow darn near anywhere. And, you know, they don't take a lot of sunlight to really germinate and take off. So, you know, that can be one of the things. If they can't even grow rye or oats in a plot like that, then we're going to definitely have to start looking at, you know, what's their soil type like, you know, something like that. As it pertains to, you know, kind of you mentioned here, about trimming back his trees or stumps, you know, stealing nutrients. I think that's kind of an interesting topic, and I've been diving a little bit more into, you know, just understanding tree roots and, you know, that whole underground, basically eco network, if you want to call it, you know, because it's a very complex thing, and it's one of the things I've just been doing a little bit more research in and paying more attention to. And, you know, one of the things that is super important as it pertains to tree roots is, you know, obviously your soil condition and type. And a lot of times if you've got more clay, you know, kind of a hard pan type soil, a lot of times those roots, especially those tree roots, depending on the species, a lot of times they won't have just a deep tap root, but they'll actually have a really wide somewhat shallow root system. And a lot of times those can be stealing other nutrients. And, you know, they really like that top 6 inches, obviously, because that's where our organic matter is at. That's where all of our different, you know, bacteria, fungi, all these different things. And there's a chart that's actually out there. And it shows, it breaks down basically, you know, all your different nutrient levels as you go down through your basically subsoil surfaces. And that top layer is really where a lot of organic matter is, and that's where a lot of your nutrients is. So, you know, a lot of times I'm trying to, a lot around a lot of small hidey hole, you know, staging food plots, I really like to try to ideally peel back a lot of my trees, you know, anywhere from that 20 to 50 yards around those small plots to allow a lot more sunlight. And of course, I really want to get that kind of that thick edge, you know, around those plots for screening. So, and then, you know, as it pertains to in those staging plots, as far as stumps, you know, if we're dealing with sandy soil, a lot of times I'm trying not to get heavy equipment in there and, you know, rip the whole stump out and stuff like that and disturb the soil more than we have to. You know, if the client really wants to just have no stumps, then we'll do that. And I've found that, you know, stump grinding is a great way to do it, where you can really mitigate, you know, how much damage you're doing. Another thing I've done is just a mini excavator. You can kind of dig around them and then just pluck them out. So that's, you know, one of the ways where I've found to, you know, remove some stumps out of that. But I would say focus on that sunlight would be the biggest thing. And then the second one would just be focusing on your soil.
Thanks. I think that's great. Couple just small additives, you know, no arguments with that response at all. What I try to do is I leave a lot of the stumps in these food plots and I burn them out. I've been doing that more recently. If you have the time to do that and you can work on a project and you can, basically what you want is you want a small kiln. It doesn't have to be that big, obviously bigger than the stump. And you take some of the debris and you start burning from the top down. And you can be there working on another area and you've got each one of these stumps burning down. Kiln wise, you know, I've found a lot of stuff online. I just built this pretty large kiln. Did you see the kiln that I built, the biochar kiln?
I don't know if you've seen. No, I think I did.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was in your story.
Yeah. It's a bit of my Yep. So something along those lines, you know, it could be a 3x3 or 4x4 foot piece of metal, you know, 18 gauge steel, something like that. It could be a little bit thicker. And, you know, you just burn down and it's a great way to mitigate those particular stumps. You could chainsaw them out. We've talked about that previous podcasts. The other thing I would recommend is over time is if you're worried about the root material, you can always break up the root material with subsoiling. I've been a really big advocate of subsoiling on ground that's got some slope to it. I would not put food plots in, you know, anything that's greater than 3% slope. And if you're going to do that, you're going to have some terracing a part of that design. The last thing is set some rules and thresholds for space. I mean, if you've got tree heights that are, if your site index is 55 to 75 feet, food plot should have at least be 6x that. So take 80, you know, 80 feet times 6, that's 480 feet. They should be at least 480 feet in diameter, at least. And so, you know, that's something to think about when you're kind of plotting things out. North-south orientation is good. I like the space and gap at the edges, you know, cut the trees away. You don't want leaf litter in your food plots. So there's a bunch of things to consider, but set a threshold, set a number. When I do clear cut openings with clients, we set thresholds. We look at tree index. We look at soil type, hydrology, all these things that are really critical. So great, great response. All right, let's bounce over to number two. Hey, John, first off, I want to say I love the podcast. It gives me a lot of imagination on what to do on my own property. I'd love to hire you one day, but I want to purchase my neighbor's property first. Cool. Get your neighbor's property. I want you to get it. Let's see, with that being said, I'd love for you to hit on a topic of improving small blocks of timber in the bottom of ag areas, or even small parcels just outside city limits around the towns. Can we improve these properties to make big bucks, mature bucks feel safe and stick around during the daylight? So this is a two-part question. How to handle small blocks of timber in bottom areas, I'm guessing bottomlands around agriculture, or just, you know, woodlots around agriculture, and even smaller parcels that are around homes where it sounds like there's a lot of activity. And so maybe those are some, I think that's the questions being asked. Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So obviously I've got a lot of small property owners that, are here in, you know, Michigan and surrounding states that I've dealt with. And I really like small properties. They have a lot of challenges to them, and they really push me to kind of think outside the box, you know, and really kind of be, you know, problem solving on a lot of these properties. And one of the things that I have noticed over and over, you know, especially in timber blocks where you've got ag ground, you know, it can be really challenging to pinpoint where a lot of your deer are going to, you know, in the evening, you know, because a lot of times you've got ag on multiple different sides and, you know, they might bed in a pocket over in your neighbor's and, you know, they basically just disperse and they might be going to three different sections, you know, in the evening. And it can be really tough. And a lot of times I'm trying to focus on a lot of small properties. I'm trying to focus on getting several doe family groups to consistently be using the property. And, you know, obviously, especially during that, you know, September through, you know, January timeframe. And so one of the things that I've seen before is not having enough food, you know, back into really good bedding cover. And there's, you know, several properties who, you know, where you got maybe a 20 acre property and it's really long and it's not very wide. And obviously there's some challenges to that, but I've seen it where they've got a lot of food in front of the property, but they've got a lot of bedding in the back, but they kind of don't have that connecting cover or connecting food. And, you know, that's where I think a lot of times really good travel corridors and staging plots, I think are really important to really hold a lot of those doe family groups within daylight hours. So they want to get up and they want to move out of those bedding areas and start feeding. And then, of course, typically make it, you know, towards that destination food source. And, you know, really, I don't really care where those deer go after dark in most of these properties. I want to keep them there basically until dark. And then ideally, I want them to disperse off some of these areas so that you can, you know, the hunter can actually get out of these areas. So I would say, you know, connecting cover and, you know, trying to get more food close back in these bedding areas is one of the things that I've seen really kind of be a gap in some properties.
So you're suggesting, Colin, that they should put food sources, and maybe you could describe that a little bit more, within bedding areas to act as an anchor to hold deer. Is that true?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And so a lot of times what I'm trying to do is really increase that not only holding capacity, but increase that attraction. So, you know, I'm using a lot of plants, a lot of perennial clovers. They produce a lot of tonnage, a lot of chicory. I really like a high percentage of chicory. It can do really well during droughts. It's got that really good taproot to it. It produces a lot of really good forage. You know, I've used alfalfa before. Alfalfa can be a little bit tricky depending on what your soil is. You know, typically likes that higher pH soil, but you know, the more diversity I can get, you know, within these areas, the better off I've found, you know, especially in these small staging plots, travel corridors. You know, plants like that can handle a lot of browse, which is really what you need. And then a lot of times I'm going back through those areas in September and I'm overseeding them with my cereal grain and my rye. And that just adds in my organic layer because typically, you know, these clovers, alfalfas, they're consuming a lot of carbon in your soil. And so we need to keep putting that carbon back into the soil every year. And I've noticed in these different clover chicory plots, after around that year 3 to 5, a lot of times they kind of start losing their attraction. And I think a lot of that reason is because being a legume, they're stealing a lot of the nitrogen. They're eating a lot of that carbon out of the soil. And I think if we can keep putting that carbon back in there, that will really help basically with that nutrient cycling process where we can really keep that plant a lot more healthy, you know, year after year. So,
yeah. Colin, I want to just add to that. I know food plots is an important topic. You know, I've talked about this, I guess probably not on this podcast, but you know, clover seems to be a very high focus point. It is for me on most of my client properties, But every single year I've reduced, when I've come up with new food plot design, I've reduced that clover component down to 20 or 30% of that total, even perennial food plot. And I've added in a whole bunch of other edibles and non-edibles in that equation. What I'm finding is clover, essentially, it destroys soil aggregation. And it almost pollutes the soil enough where there isn't enough, I want to say, air or root architecture in and around at a lower level to enhance this carbon sequestration or carbon utilization. So having that deep plant rooted chicory is helpful, but you need to have other plant types with different root architecture in and around clover. That's why sometimes these annual clovers really do really well or better for our soils, and they're much more complementary as compared to these long-term clover plots. And if somebody just thinks a clover plot is everything, the more I've done this and the more I'm starting to learn about soil and soil types and plants, the more I'm actually stepping away and trying to diversify, just like the woodlots that we're talking about, having a mix. Like if you just left all the oaks and got rid of every other species, you're like, well, I'm just improving, you know, wildlife habitat. I'm like, wait, hang on for a second. There are so many ecological services with every single different tree that's on the landscape from either a root or biomass standpoint, below the ground and above the ground. Like, have you considered every aspect of it? And most times we don't. We're like, we've got poplars, birch, you know, they're like, they're not economically viable or valuable. And I'm like, yeah, but do you know what they do for the environment? And that's where you start to lose people, because they can only think dimensionally, in the sense that that's not an economic producer or a mass producer. It's not an apple tree. It's not a crab apple tree. It's not a pear. It doesn't do anything for my wildlife. And it's like, no, it does a lot more for wildlife. You just don't recognize there's some intrinsic values, or I guess patent values, that are behind the scenes that you have to pay attention to. So I just want to kind of like take that and recognize that. Maybe I should do a podcast on understanding soils and root architecture and plants, because I'd like to really build, I talked to Al about this. I'd really like to build a whitetail landscapes, you know, food plot blend. I'm not in the business. I don't want to make money off any of that stuff. It's not my bread and butter, but I would like to see better food plot options. I'd like to see better seed options for folks. I want people to start using the BioCult Gold, the Seed Flare, the stuff that I'm using, because it works. It absolutely works. And I'm not saying that I don't make money off any of that stuff. I just want to see better options for folks, but it can't be, not everything can be dummy proof. You're going to have to think about stuff. And, you know, I think that's the one thing I want people to kind of, you know, keep in the back of their mind. Sorry. Yep. Yeah. I got a little bit off track. I'm going to add two things to the recommendation. I want to see more layering. So what I mean by that is, I talked in one of the podcasts about canvassing, about having different layers of plants. And Colin, you do a great job of this in the properties you work on, because we've talked about this, is having multiple layers interior or on the edge of your woodlots. That can construct movement in the interior. That can create screening. It can be a resource. So that's a really important thing. Consider layering. In most woodlot examples now, and then this is not considering the relative slope, but in most property designs, I have at least three layers in every aspect of bedding, separating bedding locations from bedding locations, exterior bedding locations. There's at least three layers. And so everything is separated. Even in like a small 20 or 30 yard, 30 by 30 yard section, I will have three layers of cutting between the next bedding layer. And so I'm really isolating and compartmentalizing things, but I do that in the whole cycle of design and layout. That's hard to do sometimes with the species that you're working with, but you could even have, you know, planted screens within bedding areas to separate deer, things that I don't think people really talk about. Timber bottomlands are probably the most valued resources that you could have on every property. When I go on a property and I look at every lowland area, that's usually a very water-rich area, which means there's water-rich plants, which means there's a lot of biodiversity. They can be great travel corridors in and around the edges. I cut those in a certain way. A lot of it's checkerboarding sometimes. I look at the soil hydrology, how stable the soil is. So I come up with a plan on every single area that I go in before I start just whacking and stacking trees. And I just don't want erodibility. I want to make sure I'm maintaining the water and the water infiltration within those areas, and extremely considerate of erosion and just maintaining high levels of biodiversity. And that may be introducing plants in those areas from a planting standpoint. So I just want to add to that.
Yeah, no. Well, and to add to that, I 100% agree with the layering like we've talked about. And, you know, a lot of times this layering can come in a lot of different habitat features. You know, and I try to, especially on small properties, I try to add as much food value as I can, you know, within these different screening or layering. You know, I'm a big proponent of, you know, these walls of cover or screening, you know, within bedding areas. And if I can use, you know, obviously my native trees and shrubs and stuff like that, you know, to create these different walls, that's what I really like. And one of the things I've noticed, you know, with different properties and getting client feedback on cutting as it pertains to layers is, you know, originally a lot of times I was putting a layer on the outside of the property, kind of put a wall, then you'd have an access lane. And a lot of times I'd have some client feedback. Clients would say, yeah, the deer are just, you know, they're running right past through this wall. And a lot of times these properties, there'd be maybe areas that were select cut, but they really hadn't had the core of the property done a lot of work in. And, you know, a lot of times these deer would basically run through this first wall, you know, basically being spooked from whatever neighboring hunter or something like that. And they would end up running almost all the way through the property. And obviously dealing with small properties, we're trying to really mitigate how much these deer, you know, we want these deer to basically be running on these other properties. And this is their safe area. Once they get on your property, they feel safe. They don't want to run very far. Even if you spook a deer that is on a really good, secure property, it's got everything that deer wants, a lot of times you're not going to bust that deer or he's not going to run very far. And that's one of the huge components of these walls of cover and compartmentalizing things, that when these deer get onto this property, I like having these kind of second and third walls on the interior that will kind of slow these deer down. So once they get on your property, they feel a lot more comfortable. They slow down and they've got everything they want, you know, right within that core area. So
yeah.
Wanted to add to that.
Yeah. And I think another piece is in any bottomland areas, usually they're pretty stable climates. And so it's important to make sure that you maintain some of those stable climates, because that's going to create that consistency. A lot of times you'll see turkeys put a lot of focus into those areas. They've got a lot of insect opportunities in and around those. And increasing the food values is really, really important. The escape cover option you just explained in good detail, I really feel like, you know, water can be a resource for escaping the cover aspect of it. I mean, it's not improper to change, I guess I'd call it horizontal diversity within an area. You can change the allocation of vegetation types within areas. Like if it was once a forest, you can make it a grassland setting. It will require a lot of work, but that doesn't mean that you can't make major changes. I was just working on a property that had a bunch of shrubland that needed to just be totally revitalized. And it was taking out some of the non-preferred plants, adding plants in, creating the right space so we can promote certain species, adding in fencing to promote those. I mean, my own property, I bought the Great 18, we're calling it now, the property I just bought. Okay, we walked it today, and oh my goodness, it's about 18 acres of hell right now. The way I see it, it needs so much work. And these guys, these old timers are like, well, I'm sure you know what to do, John. I said, there's so much work on this property right now. I've got soil remediation. I've got buckthorn thickets. I mean, I have everything wrong with this property that you could possibly see. And I looked at it as a disaster before I bought it. Now that I'm, you know, standing next to it, I even feel more. And somebody would look at it and be like, wow, that's a good thicket. And it's like, huh? I mean, yeah. It's definitely thick. That's great. And most people look at it as that's the level of depth that they see it. And I look at it as, I mean, I want to light it on fire. So that's
just kinda, because it's, I totally can relate to that. And I was just on a property the other day, and you know, great client, you know, been doing habitat work for a long time, and you know, just wanted to get a second opinion on a lot of things he's been doing and some layout, and just got some select cut done, and he's got a thick section on the property. You know, he's got a lot of dogwood and, you know, some low spots. He's got some tag elder, and he's also got some, you know, bush honeysuckle and autumn olive and, you know, stuff like that, that, you know, it's just going to be, have to be managed, you know, take it out in phases, you know, as you're in there doing work. But, you know, one of the things that I see often is he, you know, I was asking him his observations, you know, as far as how much he sees bedding activity throughout this area. And he says, you know, I don't see a lot of bedding activity through this area. You know, I'll see occasionally, but I just don't see the volume of use, you know, and the attraction in here. And so I'm looking around, looking at browse and looking at trails, and analyzing beds, you know, stuff like that, and looking at little subtle terrain features, you know, almost a whole totally flat property. And, but, you know, I pay attention to very subtle terrain features, and they're often, you know, key components that I'll focus in on,
yep.
You know, even a whatever 1, 2, 3, you know, 5 foot elevation change. And that's exactly where I found some beds on the property. But I think the overwhelming majority, the reason why he's not getting that predictability, he's not getting that consistent bedding there, is these deer have eaten almost all of his high quality browse, and they're left with hardly anything left there. So, you know, a lot of clients, I'm trying to focus on cutting a lot of that small diameter, you know, shrubs and, you know, small trees, saplings that has really good high concentration of minerals and nutrients. And research has shown that when you repeatedly cut these trees and they get browsed, it actually increases your attraction volume on some of these species. And so I've seen this over and over in properties, and I think it's often something that gets overlooked, where, you know, you come in, you take your overstory, you know, main trees down, you take your midstory trees, but a lot of times people aren't cutting that really small stuff, you know, they don't think it's very important. And that's one of the things I think is often overlooked, and I think it can be a missing component on some of these different areas. So
yeah, and you know, just to be more specific on my property, so one of my goals and objectives is to promote, and this may be, I have to add seed into a particular area, but 60% cover. So it's a field setting. There's some overstory trees. Again, not a lot of horizontal diversity or vertical diversity across the property. So I'm going to fix that. And then the one thing I'm really focused on is putting in more thermal circles, and essentially, you know, encasing areas for bedding purposes. And then also, you know, like to your point, I want like a percentage in each individual bedding location where there's a percentage of food, a percentage of cover, a variable cover for seasonality, you know, whether it's the hot of the summer, the cool of the winter. I want always south sun hitting certain portions of the area to create these kind of warmer zones, because it's really cold here in the north. So I'm thinking about, you know, sun exposure, tree diversity, volume of food. And this is in an area that's like, I don't know, it could be 40 yards by 40 yards. And so, you know, taking out some of those trees, and I would never go in an area like this with a mulcher. I typically use mulchers for trail systems, and usually they're access trail systems. And I'm going to do this all by hand. And it was like, oh, why would you do it by hand? That's so much work. Well, because I want to use that material, all the buckthorn that I'm cutting down, I'm going to pull it out. I'm going to drag it. I'm going to use it for back cover for bedding areas. I'm going to burn some of it in sections. I'm going to have nice little bonfires open up, and then I'll have, you know, clear ground. I can spread some seed in those particular areas. So I'm going to have a whole plan with that. Some areas I'm going to hack and squirt some of the trees. I'm not a big hack and squirt guy, but I want to introduce grapevine in those areas. Everyone hates grapevine. People are cutting down grapevine left and right. I'm promoting grapevine in certain land conditions, so, or in certain environments, yep, because it's a major benefit. In fact, today we were finding a lot of activity. Deer do, I call it rooting, but they're digging in certain areas where there's certain species of plants, and they're digging in and around the roots. They're also eating the resident seeds that have fallen from a lot of these grapes, and they're getting benefit interest to them, and they're digging through the, you know, the leaf litter to find food sources. And through every property that we're on today, that's exactly what we're seeing for edible food sources, amongst obviously eating woody material. So, you know, they're finding these little niches. So you just got to have that diversity in food sources and cover types. and I probably didn't articulate it that well, but you know, these are things that I'm trying to describe when I'm putting in bedding. And I have these really great drawings that I bring with me when I'm starting to work with clients. I just redid a whole drawing package. I just did it with my last client that I was on yesterday. And I'm really kind of breaking down the level of complexity within these areas in these drawings. And we're not listing out all the resident species or the species we prefer. But if you have anywhere between 8 to 15 different tree and shrub species in a particular area, and that could be like, I don't know, I want to say like a half an acre, you're really on your way to success. And I know that's just a really broad brush way to look at it, but you're and if they're native, of course, that's even better.
Yep.
But you're able to kind of promote this, I'll call it like an economic diversity. And for the animals, it's a place for them to reside in. And if it's structured correctly, they're going to utilize it way more. Like a travel corridor through a bottom laminate area is like, you couldn't get any better. Like I create travel corridors in and adjacent on upslopes where there's good vegetation adjacent to a riparian area. And there's going to be food, there's cover, it's great transition. They'll bed in those areas. Sometimes there's great fawning opportunities. I mean, there's just a whole host of different things that happen in and around those areas. And we just totally overlook, you know, that aspect on a property. We just look at, oh, what's the timber? Is it, you know, big enough to harvest, et cetera. So,
yeah.
Hey, we got to go down this road. We're going to run out of time. So two more questions. The next question is about hunting. And this guy's having some challenges. He's got a 22-acre property. It's extremely thick and dense. It's almost impossible to walk through. That's his first issue. Aside from a few narrow deer trails on both ends, it's about 350 yards wide, so relatively narrow property. Surrounding land is being heavily hunted. A lot of pressure on him. On the four sides, which I call the east side, it's his main access point. He's got east access. That's always a good thing. The west side is an open field that he cannot access or effectively hunt. Too thick and our predominant wind out of the west, of course, it's going to bump my scent into the bedding area. But I can hunt the north and south side. So it sounds like he has multiple access points. Right now, I'm hunting small pockets on the edges of the north and south sides. Since it's a family property, I'm somewhat limited in what I can do, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on how to make the most out of this unique setup. Small, narrow property. He looks like he has east and north and south abilities to be on the property. West, he doesn't. That's no big deal. It's a question of how to direct and move deer in and around the property so they're huntable. Hunt on the edges, but get them to come to the edges, right? What does he do? This is a tough one.
Yeah, challenging. Well, so one of the things I try to do on a lot of properties, even before I walk them, is I'm looking at things at a very large scale. So, you know, he's got a 22-acre property here. But I try to look at things at a really large scale, you know, whatever, 1,650 acres. And, you know, it might sound crazy, but I want to see how this property flows, you know, within this, whatever, given, you know, mature bucks core area, basically. And I want to figure out where I think, you know, most of these older age class bucks are going to be, where might their core area be, and then where is there going to be their main travel routes, you know, during that pre-rut time frame. And I'm looking for a lot of different features. And I think, you know, obviously you've got, with this situation, you've got some, you know, limiting factors that are going to hold them back for certain areas. But I think really looking at where are his key high percentage spots, where are those spots at that he needs to key in and focus on, and really putting together a plan to develop those key areas. And, you know, I think there's often a misconception, you know, with small properties that you really have to go in and get super aggressive, you know, and get in and hunt, you know, some of these deer. And sometimes you do. But, you know, a lot of times what I'm trying to do is increase my value and my attraction value at spots, you know, where I can get into really easily and I've got really good winds and I've got good access and build the habitat around these stand locations. And, you know, I really want to kind of build these three-dimensional stand locations where I've got multiple different edges. It connects really well with neighboring properties. You know, of course, if you can get it in situations where you don't have, you know, neighboring hunters right on the line, stuff like that, where you're kind of skirting maybe some of those areas, and you've got lots of different, maybe it'd be terrain features or edges all coming together, and really try to build these stand locations around what works best for you as a hunter, as far as access, predominant wind, and try to really increase your attraction, you know, to those points. And so, you know, without seeing the property, that's, it's tough to know exactly how that, those pieces would fit together, but that's what I'm really trying to do with a lot of properties. Obviously a small property like this, you got to be very careful as far as how much you're going in there, you know, especially if it's thick. Some areas and situations on properties, and I just was on a property the other day and we had to do this. Some areas I'm actually taking away bedding cover or potential bedding areas or areas where I'm finding beds and they're right next to access where we've got to get in because there's limited access on the property. And I'll say, yeah, we're going to just completely clear this area out, or we're going to make it so thick deer can't even get in, you know, utilize this area. Yeah. So sometimes we have to eliminate these areas in order to create a lot more, you know, predictable movement. So
can
hopefully
I,
that helps.
Yeah, that's a great response, by the way. Love it. One thing is a funny anecdote. So when I was on the property yesterday with a client, there's a really adjacent, a really nice piece of property. And this landowner next door cut this, he's a hunter, he cut this beautiful travel corridor that is abuts my client's property. And my client's property has this absolute like accented access point for him, as well as a converging hub where there's a lot of social activity. And this neighbor put this travel corridor in, and he put it right in my client's breadbasket. So he's like, I want to create this perimeter edge and so I can access and, you know, get into these areas. And what he did is he should have put it 20 or 30 yards interior to that, but he put it right on the edge. So sometimes creating these external, we'll just say trails or trail systems in and around these small properties can be a negative depending on their access point or where they're hunting. And just the related cover types and movements are pretty critical. It just happens to be a social hub where a bunch of inside corners come together. And just, it was, and yep. Again, this is the neighbor. This is even funnier. I consulted on this guy, another property for this guy. And I haven't consulted on this adjacent property. So who knows, maybe I will be doing the consulting for that one at some point. Competing neighbors. This happens a lot.
Yep.
My goodness. Yeah. Drama.
There's going to be a lot of fences.
Yeah.
That's the Midwest of the future. Right?
Yeah. It's the Don Higgins model. Just start putting up fences because that's how we keep the deer away. People have been saying that to me a lot. Are you doing what Don is doing, putting up fences? I'm like, hey, you know, if it works. Right. I mean, you know, I don't know.
So
that's great. And, with this particular individual, that's really, they've got to be smart. And one thing he did said, it's nearly impossible to walk through. Well, that seems to me, you need more space within the interior of the property. So go up and start removing some of the thickets, right? Start selecting some of the species. Like if you've got privet or multiflora rose, bush honeysuckle, start removing some of those non-desirable plants within those areas so you have more accessibility. Just because it's thick doesn't mean it's necessarily a good property. Like I said earlier, in my 18 acres of hell. All right, last question. Thanks for putting the podcast out. Appreciate it. It would be great if you dive into manipulating big woods. I hunt 40 acres that we can not TSI as far as select cut. However, I can do some hinge cutting. Okay, so you can do some hinge cutting. You can't cut big swaths. Okay, the property consists of mainly maple, poplar, and some birch. Well, I don't know what species of birch, but let's assume we can hinge cut birch. not always the case, but I've hinged north and south trying to capture sunlight. That's awesome. East to west hinges have died due to no sunlight. Could you dive deeper into this topic? Hinge direction, size of hinges, using for bedding, pinches, access, anything on this topic. Hinge cutting. Now, I didn't read this article, but somebody, I don't know who sent it to me. I don't know. Somebody sent me, quality your management must have done something, or somebody must have done a study. Maybe it was a Harper study on hinge cutting. And I don't know if they said it was great or bad. I don't even care what the study says because I've been hinge cutting for eons at this point. And overcutting is a problem. Over hinge cutting is a problem. Over, you know, harvesting trees is a problem. So too much of something is bad. This is about balance. If you're trying to get your hinge cuts to be a resource, a food resource for you, I can tell you for a fact, and I've worked on a lot of properties, that it can be a resource and it may be a resource that you want. I typically use it 99.9% of the time as structure on the landscape. And it could be, you know, for many other purposes. Colin, you can talk about this in a second, but for me, it's generally structure because I lack structure. I'm in a cold zone. It takes a long time to build understory. And without structure like that, I have no infrastructure for the deer. So hinge cutting to me is really critical, but you could have a 40-acre property and hinge cut 10% of it, very organized, like you said earlier, effectively organized to create flow and movement throughout the property. And it creates this cadence of movement on the property that actually dissects well. You can hunt it well. And it's really easy to understand. Like the last question we had, we want to move deer away from the bad neighbors and towards the good neighbors. So you can direct deer with hinge cutting or structure, you know, whatever the case may be. And so it's a huge opportunity to create this movement and flow that it would take you, if you're just planting trees, probably your whole life to make it make sense. And I could do it in about 10 minutes. So, you know, I'm going to probably pick hinge cutting, and I don't even know what the article said, but if they're saying hinge cutting is good, guys, of course it's good. I wouldn't even recommend the practice if it wasn't a good thing to do. You know, just don't hinge cut the wrong trees. And I think some of the selection here, maple, poplar, birch, usually trees are not going to hinge cut. So why don't you dialogue on this one? This is a big one.
Yeah. So, well, going back to that study real quick. So I did read most of the study. I was curious. And, you know, it's actually funny. Jim Ward actually commented on that study post when they posted it. And we were joking on the thread. He said, you know, it's funny that this had to be put into a study, you know, to really figure out that it was good, you know, or as far as being utilized by deer and increased, you know, overall holding and attraction. So, you know, obviously, you know, Jim Ward, that's one of his main, you know, TSI, if you will, you know, techniques that he uses a lot of. But it's in combination with forest stand improvement and select cut and stuff like that, you know. And then that's where, you know, I kind of wanted to break these into two different sections. So, you know, obviously you got a big woods, you know, type situation, which is challenging. A lot of times food is a limiting factor here. Cover is a limiting factor. And, you know, so that's one of the things where, you know, it gets challenging, where I see a lot of clients who come into properties and they get excited about, you know, doing hinge cutting and stuff like that. And of course, you know, with many of these clients, either they don't want to do any select cutting, or they don't have the timber value, or, you know, whatever the case might be. But they want to do some hinge cutting and they want to improve their habitat, which is awesome. And so they go in, you know, they start doing some hinge cutting, and a lot of these, you know, predominantly mid story, you know, shade tolerant trees. And so, you know, they go through and hinge cut some of these, and, you know, a lot of them end up, you know, just dying or not surviving. And so that's where, you know, even if you can't take down, do any logging, stuff like that, if you can go through and, you know, some of your just, you know, junk, lower value timber trees, if you can at least go through and, you know, I'm not a big fan of girdling or anything like that, you know, but if you can't drop them or you're not comfortable dropping them, if you can go through and at least girdle, you know, and kill some of those bigger trees. And I would say focus on pockets that you're going to have good sunlight. So obviously north and south facing slopes, you know, focus on pockets where maybe the wind has blown through. You've got some pockets that are open. Maybe you've got some diseased trees that are starting to die. Focus in on those areas where you're getting that sunlight already somewhat down there, and then start doing your, you know, your mid-story removal, you know, in there with some hinge cutting and stuff like that. And I really like to use, you know, if you got some existing treetops and stuff like that that are down there blown over or whatever the case might be, you can use that as some structure, like you were mentioning. And, you know, when I'm building kind of these walls of cover and adding structure, I've noticed that these deer really like bedding right on the edge. So a lot of times they don't like bedding kind of in these holes or putting themselves too far back. They really like being kind of right on that edge where they've got that security cover, they've got some overhead cover, but they're, you know, if there's a predator or human or whatever it might be, they can still very easily jump up and still move and, you know, get out of that area. So, you know, I would say that's one of the things that, that I would try to focus on this property is, you know, try to focus on those areas where you can get in there, you can get some more sunlight down, and then you can, you know, start removing more of those mid-story trees. And this might be a situation too, you know, if he's already got, he's already hinge cut a lot of trees and there's not a whole lot of material left, you might have to, you know, consider moving in some more shrubs, you know, that are more shade tolerant, you know, and planting stuff. Obviously it's like you were mentioning, the balance, you know, there's gotta be a balance there where you're cutting some, you're planting some, you know, and you're kind of in conjunction with both of those things and really taking in consideration your soil types up there too. A lot of times big woods, if you got a lot of red oak, stuff like that, your soil type's a little bit more acidic. You know, try and take advantage of species that'll do well there, you know, in consideration, you know, before doing those.
So. Yeah, that great response. The one thing I would say for this particular individual, you know, look across your landscape and look at, Colin mentioned this a bit ago with one of the other questions, look at the variation in terrain features. And that's going to drive your decision of making where you're going to do what. Usually in lower land settings or lower areas, we may cut heavier depending on things such as hydrology, like water infiltration in those areas, right? So those are some things to think about. Some of those higher ground or upland settings, maybe those are opportunities to grow different plant species. So, you know, you want to preserve some of those with overstory, but you want this, you know, diversity, whether it's horizontal or vertical diversity within these woodlots. So I'm spacing things out spatially so they make sense. And then encapsulate it using hinge cutting to create this architecture of layering and separation gives you that knowledge that something may exist in this, and it has that security feature, and hinge cutting can be utilized as a security feature to basically establish a focal point. And that focal point is going to be used at a much higher rate. And the other thing is directional. Like hinge cutting for me is essentially creating directional travel. I may cut an exterior to a bedding area, and I may have a cut on one side and a cut on the other side, and it's directing the deer in an orientation that's going to help move them across the landscape in a positive. I can use hinge cutting to slow deer down. I can use hinge cutting to create the right amount of cover. The height and stature of the hinge cutting is really critical, not just for the survival of the tree, but how deer will use it. Sometimes hinge cutting really, really high isn't necessarily a great thing. Hinge cutting really, really low isn't necessarily a great thing. So elevation of your hinge cuts is really critical to kind of the layout. And you can play with these different examples and see what works for your property. When I go in, there's certain species I'm going to hinge cut, not hinge cut. The National Deer Alliance, I think, released something recently on the different trees that hinge cut. I don't know if it was a Harper thing or not. If it was, check it out. Great information from whoever published that. But there's all these trees. Are they edible, not edible? Should we hinge cut? Should we not hinge cut? It was kind of a great cheat sheet. And I started looking at it the other day, and I was like, oh, this is great. A lot of it was more for this southeastern part of the U.S., but, you know, there was definitely a bunch of tree species in there that I've cut, and I could relate 100% to some of the things they suggested. And there's an art in hinge cutting. You know, trees generally have a twist to them. They all do. And so you need to understand how to cut. I think, you know, I do vertical cuts when I hinge cut, so I structure the hinge and the way it bends. I've been just doing different things, and I can tell you what trees are going to break off before I even cut them. And so just as you get more familiar with cutting different tree species and be careful about it, you'll be able to kind of select the gradient of tree that you want to cut. And you'll kind of know how you got to overcut or overapply a cut in this area to account for twisting, account for the imperfections in the tree. And certain trees cut better at certain times of the year. So there's kind of an art and a science to it. And I would just suggest, you know, just keep learning and trying. You and I, you know, Colin, we learn and we fail every day. So, you know, but I can tell you when I go in an area, this is the efficiency that you're talking about. I'm leaving trees within an area in order to create the right amount of structure. And certainly if I'm taking trees out of there and I'm not leaving tops, I need trees in there to create the right amount of structure, because I'm not going to get regeneration for 5, 6, 7, 8 years. This isn't like the South where we've got, you know, 300 growing days and, you know, things just take off. This is the northern latitudes. It takes a lot longer to, especially in these denuded soils that we're working in, to just grow plants. So just something to think
yeah.
about.
Well, one thing I would add, and obviously we could do a whole podcast on just, you know, hinge cutting techniques and what we've learned and failures and all that stuff. And like you said, I've learned a lot from my failures and you know, obviously I cut a lot of trees and I've learned a lot, you know, over the years just cutting, you know, and obviously a big proponent of hinge cutting when done right in the right situation. And one of the things that I would say, the things that I've learned, you know, a lot on just as far as reading trees, reading how they've grown. Obviously this depends on, like you were saying, moisture content. If they're down the bottom land, they'll cut a little bit differently. But reading the grain of trees, go out and cut a couple of, especially, you know, those mid-story trees. A lot of times those trees have been suppressed for a long time and the growth rings will be really tight on them and they just won't really hinge that well. And so you can learn a lot about your woods, you know, especially if it's a new property, you just bought the property, you know, you can go through, just cut a couple of small trees and read the grains on them. You can, a lot of times on properties, I can put together a lot of different pieces, when it's been select cut, how hard it was cut, how many years ago was it cut? You know, I can look back and all these different things just by reading the grain of the tree. You know, there's all kinds of different things, you know, looking at, is it a straight grain tree as far as there's no knots or anything like that. A lot of times those will split and bust. Obviously a lot of this depends on your tree species. You know, some trees I just know are not going to hinge well. They're not going to have a high survival rate. Other trees I know will be, you know, fantastic, and I'll focus more on that species. And another question that I got recently, I just figured I would answer it real quick on here. I know we're running short on time, but is the survivability hinge cut. I hear a lot about this, and I have been back to a lot of properties that either someone else has cut and done a good job with as it pertains to hinge cutting, or, you know, I have cut the property, and several years later, I've seen some of these trees that are going on 15, 20 years that have been hinge cut and been rehinged and are still alive and producing a lot of side cover and food. So just wanted to hit on that.
Yeah, some will survive, of course. And I think there's a lot that goes into tree selection, the whole spiraling of trees and just understanding that some trees are naturally predisposed to spiral more than others. And I think that's one thing that I don't ever hear that talked about.
Yeah.
And then selecting at the right elevation where to cut a tree just based on its development. You know, you pick certain points within the tree where you cut, and most species that are under 10 inches, generally speaking, most I can get the hinge. Even ones that are like really fibrous, you'd be surprised. Some won't necessarily hinge. They'll break off. Poplar is a good example. But generally, most tree species, if I take my time and they've kind of grown in a open setting where there's good water, you know, there's a good water component to the tree's development. Most of them will hinge. It's, am I trying to keep the tree alive? You know, what do I want the tree to look like? Is there a reason I want this type of structure in this area? And you've got to kind of ask yourself those questions, or would you be better served to have other resources of food in that particular area? So you just kind of got to kind of weigh those against each other. Okay, I think that's it for questions today. I was a little cynical when we started this thing, so I apologize, but I'm just a little tired. Colin, anything else from you? Anything you want to just chat about or something you want to just get off your chest?
Oh, boy. let's see. No, I mean, I think really, you know, I would say just for guys out there, you know, looking to have somebody out their property or improve their habitat, I would say, you know, look for stuff that's proven, you know, that I guess when I say proven, not only proven that somebody else, you know, as far as a consultant or a habitat guy or something like that has done and said works, but have you actually seen it work, or you've seen deer utilize these areas? And I think a lot of times, you know, we as humans are emotionally driven, you know, when it comes to hunting and habitat and design and all these different things. And deer are instinctively driven, you know, they're instinctively and biologically created, you know, to utilize these different areas and function in these different, you know, environments. And, And I think that's something that's often I tried to go back to when maybe I'm overwhelmed with, you know, there's a lot of big properties or, you know, client situation is difficult, multiple clients, and there's all these different factors that my clients face and that, you know, I'm trying to obviously help them, you know, work through these problems. And a lot of times I'm trying to pull myself out of kind of these emotion driven things as far as, you know, design aspects and focus on what do the deer want? What have I seen works and really focus on those habitat enhancement features, you know, design aspects, because at the end of the day, you really can't go wrong if you focus on what the deer want. And of course, you know, what the client's goals are and what the client wants.
So. Yeah, that's awesome. And I think it's focused on the journey, not necessarily the end game or the means to end. And in this case, a lot of the clients, they want to just have that giant buck on the wall. They want to have that experience like that. And I want them to have that experience. I want to have that experience, right? But it takes a while to get there. And again, it's almost like I say this more often than not. There's a finesse game to this. There's a patience game to this. There's a lot of thought-provoking topics related to this. You know, we're trying to create the right habitat preferences in the right area. We're trying to structure good movement. We're trying to create the ultimate interest in these properties. And at the same time, we want an outcome. And the outcome not necessarily be what we always expect it to be, but expecting a journey and realizing that if you're persistent and patient, that you will get the outcome that you want. Assuming you appreciate the journey. A lot of people that aren't able to do the work or can't do the work or scared of doing the work, if you don't take that one step of doing the work, or you're just going to sit there and say, I'm not sure what to do. You know, people that have kind of broke ground in this world have pushed the limits. And it's our job. And I like this holistic hunting land management philosophy, ecosystem design and management. It's our job to not just be habitat specialists, okay, or hunting specialists. It's our job to reshape these properties so they function, you know, well, they're used at the highest rate possible by a multitude of animals, and we increase the volume of biodiversity, increasing, you know, so many other aspects that are critical to the health side of things. And maybe a little bit out of this is we're thinking more intelligently about, you know, these properties of legacies. And, you know, I think it's important to think your property as it stands today and what it can look like tomorrow. And, you know, don't be upset you have 18 acres of hell in front of you. Just think about it. Once you start putting the effort, that hell is going to change and you're going to have more food than you ever thought, more deer interest than you ever thought, and more opportunities than you ever thought. Just be patient. And that's how I approach it every day. And, you know, it's just a journey. It always will be. So.
Absolutely. Well, never stop learning and never try to mitigate your failures, but obviously learn from as many as we can. Right.
So yep, and be open to that. All right, brother. Thanks for taking time. We went way over this today. You got some chores to do, so get to your chores and we'll talk again soon.
Sounds good. I appreciate you having me on here.
All right, brother. See you, man. Bye.
Maximize Your Hunt is a production of Whitetail Landscapes. For more information on how John Teeter and his team of experts can help you maximize your hunt, check out whitetaillandscapes.com.
I saw this app.
I got a hit.
In the new limited series, DTF St. Louis, Jason Bateman, David Harbour, and Linda Cardellini star as three suburbanites who spice up their love lives.
Wow.
Don't miss the new HBO original limited series, DTF St. Louis, premiering March 1st on HBO Max.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable.